Hi, everybody. Welcome to another very special episode of F This Movie.
Because in this one, we're loopy.
F The Music Box Massacre, where JB and I attend 24 consecutive hours of horror movies.
Or so.
At the Chicago's Music Box Theater.
The happiest place on earth.
The annual Music Box Massacre Film Festival put on by one Rusty Nails and the Movieside Film Festival. We've just gotten back from the Music Box Massacre, so we've been up for 30-plus hours straight. And even if you weren't able to attend the Music Box Massacre, you don't live in Chicago, you've never seen a Music Box, you should still listen to this show because, A, we're going to be talking about what it was like to sit in a movie theater for 24 hours and watch horror movies, and B, we're going to talk about 13 horror movies that we saw over the last 24 hours. So stay tuned. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. And do not forget, this is Horror Month on F This Movie. And if you haven't already done so, please take part in the F This Movie F Horror Movies Challenge.
Well, wait a minute. If they're listening to this,
yeah,
they found the website.
Right.
But you're giving the website. So one atom.
They could be listening to us in iTunes. They could be listening to us through DVD Verdict. They could be listening to us in Podcast Alley.
One atom in my fingernail.
Right.
Could be one whole little universe. It's so far out.
Loopy. Take the F This Movie, F Horror Movies Challenge. Throughout the month of October, anytime you watch a horror movie, go on to fthismovie.blogspot.com and find the F This Movie, F Horror Movies Challenge and post the name of the movie you watched and a 7-word review.
And again, if I could reiterate the rules, because some of you, we love you, but you're clearly not following the rules, which Patrick stated unequivocally and very clearly. You can't just think of a movie you like
right.
and post a review. That's not fair. See it and then post. And again, 7. And in the official directions, it says no more, no less, in parentheses. Some of you cannot count.
As promised, we said we were going to read some of the best entries thus far. The goal is to get over 100 in the month of October. We're somewhere over 30 as of this recording.
Which means we're going to make it.
I think so, assuming we stay on target, as that dude that blows up in Star Wars would say.
Never weaken. Post. Here are some of the best ones.
Gray Weirdo writes, Maximum Overdrive. Trucks kill people, then people kill trucks. And if you'll remember, if you listened to our last show, Maximum Overdrive was named one of the 10 worst horror movies ever made by myself and JB.
And that's a great review of Maximum Overdrive, and that's really a very concise, accurate review. Yeah. It's all you need to know.
It doesn't mention AC/DC.
No. Or the Coke can, but we'll forgive it for that.
Joey said, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, the best Scarecrow horror film ever made.
And I don't mean to be argumentative, but this begged the question, what are other Scarecrow horror films? And the only one I could think of was The Wizard of Oz.
Scared the hell out of me. Alexander said, Friday the 13th. Spoilers for Friday the 13th. It's not really Jason, it's his mom.
But if you add spoiler alert for Friday the 13th, it's not 7 words anymore.
Yeah, I just want to give everybody half a second to turn off the podcast before Friday the 13th is ruined for them. But that movie came out 30 years ago, so if you haven't seen it yet, get on the ball. Luke said, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 1974. Swing / Vroom Goes the Chainsaw Screams.
Which is great, and Luke is in middle school, and he just learned about onomatopoeia.
He needs better parental supervision during the month of October. Will said, Zombie Strippers, Zombies, Guns, Tits, Zombie Tits, Blam, The End. Oh, nope, I messed that up. Just nope. End. No, the end.
We don't know how to count.
he followed the rules. 7 words. I messed it up. I apologize.
And that review actually makes me want to see it.
Don't. It's awful.
And apparently there was someone who
yes,
and had then some difficulty with the directions again.
Jan Botig said, Howl, no werewolves? Allen Ginsberg, you tricked me.
But you could see where the title of that film might
absolutely
lead someone astray. So far, those are the best. Keep posting. We've been enjoying reading them every day as they come up.
Yeah. All right, let's get into the Music Box Massacre, because we have survived an ordeal.
It was an ordeal, and you can't see this because you're listening to it on your computer, but right now it's very dark in the room that we're in, and I'm texting with my phone on ultra bright because I want to recreate what it was like to sit in the theater and have people disregard the rules. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time ever, Rusty Nails, who we love, posted a list of rules for a better massacre, which every single person proceeded to ignore and break. I can't see a single rule here that was not broken.
Do you want to give some examples of the rules?
During my time in the theater. No alcohol is allowed in the theater. Well, yeah. That one quickly went out the window.
There were some people in front of us drinking PBRs, I saw.
I saw lots of empty beer cans, and yeah. Of course, the most wonderful sound in a movie theater, the rolling glass bottle that goes chinkity-chink up against every chair leg, but proceeds because the theater is banked, and that's not stopping until it gets to the orchestra pit. Oh, here's a funny one. No cell phones or texting during the films.
Lots of cell phones, lots of texting.
I didn't see any fights.
No, I didn't either. Although I've never seen a fight, I don't think.
And I didn't see any threats, but oftentimes threats are very quiet. They are quiet threats, and they do not call attention to themselves. Please clean up after yourself.
I can't believe they would show any movie after the Music Box Massacre ends, because that theater is in bad shape.
But here's the conclusion I reached, because I tried to pick up stuff around me.
As did I.
As we left. But usually at 11:30 in the afternoon at the Music Box, they show a matinee of a classic film. Because the massacre goes till noon, they're not going to show the matinee film on Sunday. And so in theory, they have at least an hour and maybe two.
That's not enough time for what has happened in that theater. We should talk a little bit about what the Music Box Massacre is. This was the sixth one. Like we said, it's 24 hours of horror movies. It starts at noon on a Saturday. It goes till noon on Sunday. You buy one admission. You get a wristband. You can come and go as you please. People bring blankets and pillows. You can kind of bring in your own snacks and drinks and stuff, and that's how alcohol ends up inside.
I saw a couple people in pajamas, which was entertaining. Oh, and to be fair, just about the rules, do not take multiple seats for your personal items. That's a rule that I broke, my personal item being my ass.
So this was the first year, maybe I should be ashamed to admit this, or maybe I should be proud to say this, I don't know. This was the first year, because I knew we were doing this podcast.
He's dedicated, folks.
I decided to tough it out for the full 24 hours. I've never done that before. I think the most I made it was about 16 one year. But today I went the full 24 and haven't slept in 30-something hours.
And he did that for all of you.
That's right.
Because he thought if he was going to cover it, he should cover it. I, on the other hand, reverted to my original strategy, which is to stay until the movies get to a string, perhaps, if you're lucky, of stuff you're less interested in seeing, which is usually between 12 and 2 in the morning. Drive home like a maniac, try to sleep for a couple hours, take a shower, very important, and then stroll back in the theater. In this case, I'm strolling back for Theater of Blood, which was I was really happy I didn't miss it. And you stroll back into the theater fresh as a daisy, and as I've said many times in the past, the rest of the theater resembles a refugee camp.
It really does. People were huddled under blankets. Couples were hugging each other as though they had just been through something traumatic. I looked around at one point like, wow, this really does look like post-Katrina. Yeah.
That's the metaphor that came to me today, too, and I've never used that one. This is the, what was that stadium that they used?
The Superdome? I have no idea.
Because usually I would fall back on like Prisoner of War camp.
Right.
But this morning it was definitely post-Katrina. Yeah. And As some of you know, people who are really big fans of horror films, unfortunately, don't always have the best hygiene. Go to any Comic-Con and you'll witness this phenomenon. Enough said. So when you combine bad hygiene with 24 hours in a motion picture theater without changing your clothes, it's a volatile mixture. But at this point, we've gone 10 minutes and it sounds negative, and we have to take a right turn. We're loopy and we just left the theater and we're full of all these impressions and stuff. We love The Massacre.
Yeah, we look forward to it all year.
And we're nitpicking because, you know, we're trying to be entertaining and it's more fun to be critical sometimes. Rusty started it 6 years ago. I think I've been to every one. And it's terrific. It's really, really a lot of fun. So let's stay positive.
Yeah, absolutely. He picks great movies every year. I have to give huge credit because I know there's a lot of people that stay for 24 hours every single year. And I give those people all kinds of credit because by the end of this massacre, I felt like the fact that I'd stayed all the way through was doing the later movies a disservice.
Which I even felt, even though I went home and got 40 winks. Since my first massacre, it's very strange if you've never seen more than three movies in a row. Around the fourth, fifth, or sixth film, it starts to play with your mind in very odd ways. It's very much like a drug.
At the start of each movie, I had to go back and recap everything, every movie that had led to that, just to sort of get my bearings and know how much I had seen and what I had seen. Psycho was one of the... We'll get to the lineup. We're going to go through the lineup.
Yeah.
But one of the last movies that they showed today, it was movie number 12 of 13, was Psycho.
And the Psycho, original Psycho.
The original Psycho, not the Vince Vaughn one. Rusty couldn't get a print of that. So, and Psycho's great, obviously. Again, if you listen to our Best and Worst show, you know that it was picked as one of the best horror movies of all time. It's great. Psycho's awesome. It never felt as long as it did today. Because it was the 12th movie I had seen in hour 22.
And this just goes to show how subjective things are because I've shown it many, many times in class. I think that might be the movie I've seen the most times in my life. And because I had gone home, taken a little nap, taken a shower, I thought this morning was one of the fastest it
had
ever seen. I swear to you.
We were in very different places.
And literally we're in very different places because I moved to a less crowded place in the theater at that point because Rudy McRude-Rude with his a texting cell phone was bothering me, so I moved away.
So let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
The very first movie that they show pretty much every year is a silent film with live organ accompaniment. And this year's silent film was the Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera. And for coverage of that, I turn it over to JB, scholar of all things boring. It's not boring.
Dennis Scott did the live organ accompaniment. The Music Box still has its original Mighty Wurlitzer theater organ because the Music Box was built in the last 2 years of silent film. Dennis Scott, I have seen and heard him perform many, many times, and he is one of the best who does this currently. His accompaniment was really, really great. And oddly enough, and I was sharing this with Patrick on the way home, I think I've seen Phantom of the Opera accompanied live three or four times. In fact, there was a time, and maybe this is back when Patrick was younger and I was younger, and people were willing to go to these things. And now you don't see it as much because maybe young people are not as willing to do this anymore. But at colleges, a very popular Halloween attraction would be. They did it at Harper College. I saw them do it at U of I. They used to do it in the city sometimes. That as a fundraiser, they would show Phantom of the Opera and have the local community college orchestra or the local symphony orchestra accompany it. And that was a Halloween attraction. It was also a way to raise money. You don't see that very much anymore. You know, Phantom of the Opera is great. It's not the greatest horror film ever made, but it's wonderful, and it's got Lon Chaney. I thought it was interesting.
Not enough Lon Chaney.
Well, like
all of his classic films, let's only have him be in about a tenth of it.
Yeah.
We don't quite know what to do. What I found interesting yesterday morning, because I haven't seen it in a year or two, is that there's the iconic scene where Mary Philbin grabs the mask off of him.
Right.
And that's the big shock moment. And there's many stills of the film with Chaney's makeup. Throughout the film, depending on what scene you're in, the makeup looks very different.
Yeah.
And in some of the scenes where he has to sort of talk more or emote more, it doesn't look as horrific as it does in some of the stills and in the unmasking scene, because it sort of had to be more workable with what he had to do. But it was very entertaining.
It is very entertaining. We recently saw a screening of Man of a Thousand Faces, the James Cagney biography of Lon Chaney, and watching that movie, it was amazing how much worse the Phantom of the Opera makeup looked when, you know, it had been 30 years or so. You would think they could have done at least as good a job with the makeup, but it looked terrible in that movie.
And one of the big problems in that film is, although I am a big fan of Jimmy Cagney as an actor, and he was a fine choice to play Lon Chaney, if the man was known as the Man of a Thousand Faces, you can imagine that some of the film will be spent talking about these amazing makeup creations of his. Cagney's face, literally, his face cannot be any more different than Lon Chaney's face. So what you're seeing is the Phantom makeup adjusted for someone with a much pudgier face.
And I guess maybe that's the problem, is that it was...
In all of the makeups in that movie they show...
But he only wore maybe two or three in the whole movie, because for the most part it was just a montage of posters.
Right.
You see him in the Hunchback makeup and the Phantom makeup, and that's about it.
And maybe it says something about the time in which the film was made, that people are more interested in romance or some sort of soap opera story. But the biggest problem with The Man of a Thousand Faces is they spend almost no time on why the man was famous to begin with, and all of their time on this backstage nonsensical
personal drama with his kid and his wives and his parents and their
son, and it's very soapy.
There was a moment near the end of Phantom of the Opera where he's asking Christine to make a choice, and if you turn the scorpion, then your lover lives, but you're stuck with me, and if you turn this other thing, then the whole opera house blows up, or I don't know. And she turns, I guess, the scorpion, and her lover, Raoul, who's about to asphyxiate or burn to death.
The room they're in gets very hot.
Right, which, I don't know. all of a sudden, it starts to flood. And there was a group of people behind us, high school students, and I heard the girl gasp when it started to flood, and I thought, wow, this movie is still working on a teenager.
Okay.
So that was neat.
And that's always good.
It was a positive, right. Well, what came next?
After Phantom of the Opera, and it's always really nice, well, I really like silent films, so I think it's great that Rusty always starts with a silent.
Yeah.
And that he then...
Next year, London After Midnight.
That is an inside joke, my friend, an inside joke. After that, he showed The Raven from 1935, one of the few films that stars both Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, although clearly Karloff has the supporting role.
But he's top billed.
Because of his contract with Universal.
Right.
And at this point, I think Patrick and I differ in that I've noticed this effect at The Massacre, and I've really noticed this effect at Ebertfest, that once you start dealing with films that are sufficiently old, there's a segment of the audience that desperately wants to feel superior to them. And so, please note, this is kind of hard to put into words. I want people to have a good time. I want people to enjoy the films on whatever level they want to enjoy them. But at some point, I think it becomes a little bit like mocking, or the audience refusing to say to themselves, things were different in 1935. Audiences were different. Society was different. So my feeling during The Raven is that people are hyper-attuned to ironic possibilities, and they're going to admit no opportunity to laugh derisively at something that's old-fashioned. And I think it's a shame, because clearly in The Raven, Lugosi's chewing the scenery.
Right.
But it's really great chewing of the scenery. It's Lugosi chewing the scenery.
That movie was very... I had never seen it. It was very, very entertaining. I had a blast with that movie. But how do we differ in that opinion?
That I think when it was happening, we briefly talked about it, and I think it was you who said some films from the 30s don't translate very well to today.
Oh, maybe.
And maybe we're just splitting hairs here, or maybe I'm being tut-tut grandpa saying, now you will not laugh at Bela Lugosi. You can laugh at Bela Lugosi all you want. It's just, again, I've noticed this at other film festivals. I didn't think the audience was giving the film a chance. Now, that being said, the next film, The Wolfman, I guess I missed the funniest piece of audience participation ever. I don't know if I was going to the bathroom or not paying attention, but
I missed it also.
Someone in the film said something, and it was a perfect setup for somebody in the audience yelling, that's what she said,
yeah.
And oh, it brought down the house. Watching The Wolfman, though, I was reminded that several months ago, we talked about The Wolfman.
Yes, we did. The remake.
On the podcast, and watching it again on the big screen, which is always great and a great reason to go to
on
the
film,
massacre.
Rusty almost always shows these movies. Film prints, not video.
That you're watching the original Wolfman, and the Chaney character is sort of supposed to be this lovable rogue, and he has all this dialogue that sounds like it's supposed to be delivered by Leslie Howard. But he's not.
No.
Smooth.
No.
And it comes across really odd.
Yeah.
The minute he becomes the Wolfman, he's fine, because he's really good at playing tragic, misunderstood.
Right.
But for the first 20 minutes of the film...
Well, that whole sequence in the antique
exactly,
shop is...
Where he's romancing Evelyn Ankers as Gwen
right.
Conliff. It's just demented.
Well, and again, there's a situation where the audience is laughing because in 2010 terms, he's this creepy stalker, and that's not what it was when the movie came out, and that's not necessarily the terms in which we should watch it, but yeah, we're watching it now, and that's how it's coming off. The Wolfman, I thought, to go back to something you said about The Raven, like, the laughing during The Raven didn't bother me as much, because I think that movie knows it's being funny.
Yes. In many cases.
Yeah. And not in every single case, you know, people laugh. The problem with something like this, and I noticed it the first time I went to The Massacre. Again, it's not a problem, but what happens at something like The Massacre, it is an unconventional way of seeing movies. You're seeing a bunch at a time and a big group of people who all are excited and pumped up and love horror movies. And what happens a lot of times is it turns into sort of a party atmosphere. And a lot of times that is great and it makes it so much fun because you're all having a great time together. But what The massacres are programmed in such a way, Rusty picks a wide variety of movies. And so while The Raven is sort of over the top and self-aware and funny, The Wolfman isn't. And you can't treat those two movies the same way. But sometimes the audience does. Every movie is a big party movie, and we comment along with it, and we're laughing at every line, and everything's a party. But the movies are very different.
And to be fair, this is a big group of horror fans.
Yeah.
And part of it is this communal acknowledgement of what we share. So, for instance, this morning, after the shower scene in Psycho, there is applause.
Yeah.
Because we are acknowledging that's the sequence
right.
that is so famous and so great for so many reasons. And obviously there's often applause during the credits.
Always for the titles, for the directors, and if there's a guest in attendance, when that person's credit comes up, the audience always applauds. And I always like that. I think it's respectful and great.
The greatest thing was, a long time ago, Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller had this sort of movie club thing that he would do in New York. It was a small cadre of people who would go see movies together. And they had all these rules. There were all these rules for Movie Club. And one of them was, if the title...
You do not talk about Movie Club.
If the title of the film actually comes up in the dialogue, everyone in Movie Club, the tradition became, everyone in the Movie Club sitting in their seats would go, yes. And that happened
yep.
during Killer Clowns
yep.
from Outer Space.
Yep. Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Yeah.
John Vernon.
The cop who doesn't believe it says it out loud.
Sergeant Mooney.
And the audience goes crazy.
Yeah. Because talk about shoehorning it in. I mean, that title is, you know, left field to begin with, and then to have it come up in a line of dialogue. I will have more to say about potentially inappropriate audience response later on in the podcast.
And it was great to see the Wolfman and the Raven on the big screen. Yeah. One of the things I really appreciate, obviously, if you listen to the podcast, is I am very into the original Universal horror films from 1931 to 1941, and I can't thank Rusty enough for the fact that I had never seen Bride of Frankenstein on the big screen until Rusty showed it. I had never seen several other of the Universal films mm-hmm. on a big screen mm-hmm. until Rusty showed it, so I appreciate it.
And they're really good prints. I thought the print of the Raven and the Wolfman, I thought, were both good.
Which is doubly ironic when you consider that something awful happened in the late 60s, early 70s to film prints or something. Whenever you go to one of these film festivals or whenever you see a theatrical print of a film from the late 60s or early 70s, it's always beat to shit.
Yeah, which again comes up later in the podcast.
And maybe part of the problem is the Universal films are so universally,
right.
Pardon the pun, loved and acknowledged that Universal has said, we need to put some money into their preservation because these are going to be cash cows for us for a long time.
Right.
Whereas some of the films with really bad prints are very much orphaned films.
Right, and they're obscure and harder to find, and we'll get into that in just a second.
And speaking of orphan films...
There we go.
Next, we have a very obscure George Romero film from 1973... I don't know anyone who had ever seen it before. I certainly hadn't seen it before. From 1973, it's Season of the Witch, which, interestingly enough, was not the title on the print we saw.
Hungry Wives.
Yes, because obviously there was a distributor somewhere who had a really hard time getting theaters. I'm thinking a special kind of theater to book Season of the Witch. And discovered that Hungry Wives was, ever so much
and
more commercial.
And imagine if you're the guy who's like, I'm going to go see Hungry Wives. And then you go see Season of the Witch. You might end up with blue balls.
And Season of the Witch had the first guest of the massacre, Jan White, who was the star of that film. And she appeared after the film and answered questions.
And had apparently does not regularly make... convention appearances?
They said that this was her first convention appearance.
Yeah. I did not love Season of the Witch.
Nor did I.
And I don't want it to seem like... Because, again, we very much love The Massacre, and we very much appreciate what Rusty does.
And I love having the chance to see it.
And that's what I was about to say. Just because we didn't like a movie doesn't mean we're mad that he showed it. Because I'm happy that he shows everything that he shows. I wouldn't have gotten to see Season of the Witch otherwise, particularly a film, you know, a print of it. So I'm glad to have seen it. I just didn't enjoy it.
Very true. And again, as you said, the fact that they're showing all these films in a row, the fact that when we sit down at the Massacre to see Season of the Witch, we've just seen three other films, I think it's something to do with it. And we're sitting there, and we're watching Season of the Witch, and we're I'm up.
You were saying we're watching Season of the Witch.
Did we see Season of the Witch?
We saw Season of the Witch, and Jan White was there in person.
I thought I dreamt that.
It's a very dated movie. George Romero is obviously trying to say some things sort of socio-politically.
About the emptiness of suburban life.
Right.
About...
I got a real Stepford Wives vibe off of it.
The desperation that women hit when they reach a certain age, if they've made a decision to marry and have households and children. I thought the film's intent was noble.
Right. And more than once, it started to go somewhere where I thought, oh, I kind of see where this might go, and I'm interested in that. But it would quickly back off of that.
Because we have so much respect for Romero, and as it stands, for his other better films, that it becomes a time capsule of how ugly things were. In 1973, the way people would decorate their houses, the way people would dress, or just how instantly identifiable it is when you see an early 70s film. And folks, I was there. I was there in the early 70s. It was an ugly time. That what I said in the car on the way home was, Romero avoids every cliche of low budget, small, independent, first-time filmmakers in Night of the Living Dead. And of course, Night of the Living Dead is one of the most amazing films ever made. And it's almost as if by pulling off that trick, he then makes a film that has every single cliched, hackneyed, trite device. And again, his intent was honorable, but the film is kind of a mess.
Yeah, definitely. After Season of the Witch and Jan White's Q&A, and she was very pleasant and forthcoming about her experience making the movie, was Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And the Kyoto brothers were there in person.
Very much in the spirit of the festival. I had never heard them speak before, and they were very much in not only a party mood or party atmosphere, but they know what film they've made.
Right.
Yeah, they're unapologetic about what it is, and that it succeeds admirably for what it's trying to do. What I thought was interesting about their talk was, because they're so good at special effects, I thought the film looked really good.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started talking about just how low budget it was.
Right.
And that there was a deleted scene, and one of the reasons they had to cut it was because the paint was still wet on the floor, and that interrupted what was supposed to happen in the scene. The film looks good, and it looks interesting. I like the design of the clown creatures. All the stuff with the cotton candy and the popcorn guns
they sat down and thought of, okay, what's every gag we can come up with that's sort of clown related, and did most of them, I think.
And that's interesting because I think the funniest joke in the film, and one of the Kyoto brothers said it's his favorite joke, is not something you automatically associate with clowns. It's the shadow puppet gag.
Yeah.
Which he revealed was actually animated.
They were very likable. They stuck around for a long time afterwards. And that film, we were observing during this year's massacre. A couple years ago, it was the most crowded it had ever been, almost uncomfortably so, because Clive Barker was the guest.
In person.
He was there to talk about Midnight Meat Train, my favorite horror movie of all time. And it was very crowded to see Clive Barker. And this year came close, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized the largest audience was there for Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and apparently that movie has a much larger following than I was ever aware of.
And obviously I'm a little older, but my feeling was that Killer Clowns, much like Fright Night, which was the last film in the rotation, have a reputation among people younger than me. Because when they were small, they saw them a lot on either VHS or cable, and they have a lot of affection for them.
Killer Clowns, in particular, used to play a lot on, like, HBO.
And it's goofy fun.
Yeah, I don't have anything bad to say about it. It's fun, and it's the right kind of movie for this kind of atmosphere, because everybody's there to have a good time and laugh, and it's fun. It didn't really overstay its welcome, I don't think.
Well, it was interesting in that Killer Clowns from Outer Space perfectly captures the sort of communal party atmosphere of the massacre, and so does Basket Case. And I thought it was interesting that scheduled between those two films was a very disturbing David Cronenberg film called Rabid, the feature non-porn debut of Marilyn Chambers. And, you know, the film starts out slowly, and it builds suspense, and for a while you're not exactly sure what this is going to be or what it's going to become or where it's going to go. And, of course, I had seen it before, and it was just so wonderful Earlier, Patrick referenced the fact that something happened in Phantom of the Opera that made some younger people behind us gasp. That the same thing happened with Rabbit. They were literally out loud saying things like, "What? How?" And I sort of turned around at one point and said, "You'll see."
Right.
Because
they wait a while to reveal
what it is.
Yeah.
And if anything, it shows just how advanced and transgressive Cronenberg was for 1977, because the central conceit of that film is still very disturbing based on the audience reaction.
Yeah.
And the special effect holds up too.
Yeah, I mean, it's icky.
It bothered people.
Yeah.
Although not as much as something that came a little later in the show.
During Basket Case?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Rabbit is, to me, it's one of those movies that's more interesting than good. There's a lot of things I like about it, but
it seems to be early working versions of themes that he would explore in other films.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, it's a different take on Shivers.
Very similar.
Shivers, I think, and yeah. Rabbit have a lot in common, and again,
outbreaks of disease. And
in the car on the way home, I was joking to Patrick that perhaps the U.S. government should look into the fact that I think David Cronenberg might have invented AIDS. Because before the spread of AIDS, before the disease was known or real, Cronenberg makes all these films about the horror from within, the horror of disease, the horror of uncontrolled sexuality, the horror of a terror that's inside of you that's spread communally. And then, as if to make his films real, we get the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. At which point he stops making films about the horror of disease and then starts making other films about even more twisted subjects. How erotic car crashes are, for example.
The answer, very. Just ask Rosanna Arquette's leg wound. So Rabid was kind of a...
I think Rabid was...
People didn't know how to respond to Rabid.
No, especially after Killer Clowns.
Yeah.
Rabid was a palate cleanser
between
Killer Clowns and Basket Case. Really, those two should have been scheduled back-to-back.
Killer Clowns and Basket Case?
Yes.
Yeah. But again, you get guests and you think maybe their schedules are different, although there to speak on behalf of Basket Case was the film's star, whose name I will most likely mess up.
I've heard it pronounced so many different ways.
Kevin Van Hentenreich?
Hentenreich.
Hentenreich?
Yes, I believe that's right.
He actually was there a lot earlier than, so theoretically they could have put those films back to back. But let's talk about Basket Case, which was the only film shown at this year's Massacre on video, perhaps.
I can imagine what a theatrical print perhaps
a good theatrical print does not exist. Although, wouldn't you argue that that might be part of its charm?
Well,
given... If the print really was beat to shit and looked like a sleazy 42nd Street print.
No, given scratchy and splicy and authentic and beautiful and every frame and...
I guess.
I know which one I vote for. I would say, in terms of the Massacre experience, that Basket Case was the most successful film.
Oh, okay.
It was, and continues to be, very entertaining. Yeah. It was exactly what the audience came to see. The audience was on the same wavelength. Basket Case is clearly a film that delivers, if that's the type of film that you want.
By the way, saying that the audience was on the same wavelength really says something about the audience for the Music Box Massacre, because that is not an easy movie to be on the same wavelength.
The audience was on the wavelength for a film about a young man who carries a wicker basket around with him. People are constantly asking him what's in the basket. And of course, spoiler alert, one, two, it contains his deformed mutant Siamese twin brother, who was...
Like a baked potato made of silly putty with a face.
That's a very good description of Belial. That this brother was cut from his side against his wishes by a series of doctors. So the film is low budget, it's very silly, it's very tongue-in-cheek, and yet it's incredibly violent.
Yeah.
And contains this very disturbing transgressive image at the end.
Which I had forgotten.
To sort of slap anyone in the face who says, I love Belial. Yeah, right. He's a little cute dumpling. Because if there's anything worse than a mutant baked potato half-brother raping your girlfriend, it's your mutant baked potato half-brother raping your girlfriend after she's dead.
Yeah.
And that got to some people.
Yeah.
It's like the filmmaker, Frank Henenlotter, is punishing you for enjoying the more comic aspects of the film.
I got the impression that a lot of people had seen Basket Case, which is great because obviously that makes it more fun. People know what to expect and people get the tone of it. But I think it also would have been a lot of fun if that was the first viewing for a lot of people.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, they showed May, which was a movie that not a lot of people had seen. And I can't compare to Basket Case because they're two very different movies. But I, as someone who had seen May and really likes May, it was a lot of fun to listen to the way that that movie affected people and made them uncomfortable in a way that they didn't want to feel. There was a lot of nervous laughter in that movie.
And the first time I saw May ever was at the massacre. And I remember at one point, because we had gone with a large group, a friend of our family turned to Patrick during May and said,
basically, what's going to happen?
Because, unlike most films, in May you can't figure that out for yourself. But yeah, I still remember that. Basket Case was fun. It was exactly what the audience had come for.
Yeah, it's strange and violent and...
It was scheduled at a good time because it was right before midnight, and at midnight, the grind...
Things change.
The grind of the marathon really starts to take its toll.
You've sat through seven movies at that point. You're sitting there, holy shit, I've seen seven movies. And then you realize you are halfway done.
Which is sobering. And oddly enough, after Basket Case, there are people who leave, but... there's just as many people who get there at midnight because I guess some bars are closing or something.
Right.
And then there's this other influx of people who are so lucky because the people who come at midnight get to see Pet Sematary, The Fun House, and House by the Cemetery.
Which you didn't see.
But
we'll
I went home.
We'll spend some time talking about those. In the past, I've left a lot of times, sometime between like midnight and 2 or midnight and 3, and I'm always amazed at how many people are still there, standing around, arriving, smoking out front, just that this is just going for them, and it's over for me. So the next film is Pet Sematary. And I got to spend some time talking about Pet Sematary for a couple of reasons.
I don't want to be buried in no pet
The great
cemetery.
Ramones theme song. All right, so...
Those are all the lyrics.
I'm on record as saying that Pet Sematary still contains the thing that scares me more than anything else, and that is Sister Zelda with the spinal meningitis laying in the bed all scary, and it's terrifying, and I watched people around me recoil at times when she comes running towards the camera in her last little sequence. People recoiled because they were just as scared as I was.
And what I didn't know, and that my wife shared with me later, was that when you first saw Pet Sematary, you were 11.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, well.
Although my wife agreed with me with my historic objection to Pet Sematary, but also made a comment about the audience that you have at the massacre at around 1 in the morning, and that they convince you this is the cutest kid who ever lived, and then he gets run over by a truck.
Spoilers.
Too late. And I guess when that happened, there was a gasp from the audience, because it's a surprise, but then, according to my wife, there was laughter.
And this is what I wanted to get to, what we were talking about with the Raven and the Wolfman and that atmosphere. Is it that the audience, again, is so whipped up into a frenzy that this is a fun party and everything exists to be laughed at and cheered because we're at a horror movie festival and we love horror movies? Or is it, I'm in this mood and this just made me feel something I don't want to feel, and so I'm just going to laugh as a cover?
Which I've always called protective laughter.
Right. And I think it might have been because, again, Rusty programs all these different kinds of movies, and I don't think people knew how to react to something that was that horrible when they had just seen Basket Case and Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and they're in that mode, and then we're seeing a little kid get run over by a truck. I don't know, but that was a low point for me, hearing the audience laugh when the boy gets run over in Pet Sematary.
And again, full disclosure, I went home and slept during Pet Sematary, The Funhouse, and House by the Cemetery. So now, while Patrick discusses those films, I'm going to go to sleep.
We haven't slept a lot, okay? We've been up for 30-something hours. I used to kind of like Pet Sematary. I'm gonna try and talk a little quieter because JB really is asleep. So I used to kind of like Pet Sematary. I always thought it was a nasty, ugly movie that was effective in being a nasty, ugly movie. This was the first time I'd seen Pet Sematary since having a child of my own, who just happens to be around the age of the little boy in Pet Sematary. And it was a very different experience watching Pet Sematary this time. I really, really didn't like that movie. And I used to kind of like it. And I didn't just not like it because of what it does to the kid. I didn't like it for a lot of reasons. It incorporates all these things that I think come from the book that the movie isn't willing to spend any time on. And I haven't read the... Have you ever read the book? He's nodding in his sleep. I assume that the book is sort of about grief and the way that people deal with it and the extreme places that people will go to come to terms with grief or to put off feeling that way or to undo mistakes or something. And the movie, in theory, is about those things, but really it's just about exploiting the most obvious horrible elements of that. And I had a really hard time with that movie.
I'm up. I'm up. And I woke up because I wanted to congratulate Patrick because I dreamt that Patrick was talking about Pet Sematary and his opinion of the film has been lowered since he had a child himself.
Yeah.
So I specifically woke up to congratulate you for growing up.
Thank you.
Because one thing that I continually think during the massacre, and this came up in our F the Summer podcast, you look around the theater at times during this 24-hour horror marathon, and because of the films, because of the way some people act, the way the audience reacts sometimes, I just look around and say, we're all 12.
Yeah.
We're all 12 years old.
The next movie was The Fun House, a sort of little scene Toby Hooper movie.
That was actually not the original title of the film.
What was the original title?
The original title of the film was The Far From Fun House.
You don't like The Fun House.
But they thought, no. Not at all.
I actually thought The Funhouse was not bad. I thought it was placed just right.
For people to sleep.
Well, yeah. The print was actually really nice. And that is a very colorful movie, actually. Mm-hmm. And the print was really good. And it was the first movie that they showed in like full widescreen. I don't think The Funhouse is that bad. I think if you cut a half hour out of The Funhouse, which is a lot of time for a movie, you'd have a really tight, good little horror movie. But The Funhouse, I think, for me, was sort of a we were talking about palate cleansers, maybe because Pet Sematary is so ugly and mean-spirited, and The Funhouse isn't. It's just kind of a fun horror movie.
So The Funhouse was made how many years ago?
30, almost.
Right. So when that movie came out, I was 19.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that my opinion of that film might have changed, may have changed. Much like your opinion of Pet Sematary, because I literally haven't seen it since 1981.
Okay. Had you stayed and watched it, I think you would have had an okay time. Now, I say that recognizing that almost everyone around me seemed to not like it. Either they went to sleep. I'm by myself at this point, by the way. Either they went to sleep or the ones who did stay awake were complaining about how they didn't like it, how there was too much screaming in it.
Because they were trying to sleep.
Yeah, so that not a lot of fans of The Funhouse. But I liked it, and I appreciated the fact that Rusty showed it, because it's not a movie that gets screened a lot. After that, however, is House by the Cemetery, a Lucio Fulci movie. And again, Rusty, I know, is a fan of the Italian zombie films, a fan of Lucio Fulci. I recognize that he has a large following. I, once again, am not part of that following. I think I have yet to see a Fulci movie that I really like.
And again, that was not the original title of the film. That was the Americanized title. The actual Italian title translates to Tired House by the Sleepy Cemetery.
It was... that, I think, was the low point for me, because at that point I had been awake for I don't know how many hours, and I was downing energy drinks trying to... Because the Music Box Massacre is sponsored by Monster Energy Drinks, and they come and drop off lots of free Monster. And so...
Yum.
I had three or four of them trying to stay awake, and I don't really know why I did for House by the Cemetery, because no one else did. I literally walked up and down the aisles during House by the Cemetery, and everyone had gone to sleep. And it was probably the right move, because that is not a movie that I liked at all.
And it begs the question, is there any movie that's good at 4:15?
Probably not. So again, it's placed just right, but it's a kind of horror that I don't like. It's just... long stretches of tedium and badly dubbed dialogue punctuated by really nasty, mean-spirited violence where you can't just show a knife slit a girl's throat. You have to show it literally saw into her neck over and over and over as blood sprays out.
And at this point, JB, fresh as a daisy, waltzes back into the theater.
That's right. For Theater of Blood.
Man, my timing could not have been better. The opening credits were concluding, and I can't remember the first time I saw Theater of Blood, but it's very entertaining, although a little overlong. But again, it's at this point that the weight of the massacre starts to get to you, and is the film overlong, or is it overlong at 5:45 in the morning?
I would argue it's overlong anyway, but it's really overlong at 5:45 in the morning, because I couldn't believe how many critics had to be dispatched.
The plot of the film is that Vincent Price plays a hammy actor, big stretch.
Really well.
And
talk about going over the top.
He is not, his work is not enjoyed by, I believe there were 27 or 28 newspaper critics.
I have a theory that Theater of Blood is the precursor to the Saw movies, by the way.
Oh, because of the gimmicky
murders
and the red-hot daggers on a little train car.
Right, right.
So this Shakespearean actor decides to do away with all of these critics. He's very angry at them, and each of the murders is patterned after a Shakespeare play. So I'm giving the film a lot of credit for being clever and knowing a lot about Shakespeare. A whole slew of really fantastic English character actors show up. Michael Horton's in at the beginning of the film. He's the first victim. Diana Rigg shows up, cuter than a button.
In drag.
Well, spoiler. Robert Morley, who himself is over the top. And Milo O'Shea, who's been in a lot of things. He's the friar in Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, shows up as a police detective.
Duran.
He's Duran Duran in Barbarella. That it's obvious, especially with the film's conclusion, that this movie cost a bit of money.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end, they it might just be movie special effects, but they seem to set a live theater on fire.
Right.
Perhaps it was not used anymore or abandoned, but we have all these famous actors. We have a script that, at worst, is very literate, and it's a lot of fun. And I also really like the point they made that an actor's job is not easy, and these critics have or might have ruined lives.
Right.
That there is, they have done harm.
Right, that the words that they choose do have an effect on an actual human being.
And there's a little slam at method acting, because at one point he loses an award to another actor we never see, but whose description sounds a lot like the Marlon Brando, James Dean, early 50s method acting school. Theater of Blood is fun.
It's a lot of fun. It's really funny, you know, in like a sly way. It's very entertaining, and it was a great sort of reset, especially coming off of a few movies that... put some people to sleep, or that there were mixed feelings about. You know, people didn't seem to really love the Funhouse. Nobody really got into House by the Cemetery, but Theater of Blood, I think, brought everyone back in because it's so entertaining.
Theater of Blood was definitely the reset, although I think part of it was I returned to the theater, and when I'm there, the party can start up again.
Well, and so now we're in the home stretch, because I know, okay, Theater of Blood means there are three movies left to go. And after Theater of Blood comes Psycho.
And if you're interested, the film is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and not only was it included in The Massacre, but it is playing at the Music Box for the rest of the week. This being the week that begins October
10th.
So if you're listening to this Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday when we originally posted, and if you live in the Chicagoland area, you can actually go see Psycho. That would be a great thing to do. The print was very nice looking, yeah. Although it didn't impress me as being a print that was struck for the anniversary. It looked a lot like the print I saw the last time Psycho was at the Music Box.
But Psycho's great, and we kind of already talked about it at the beginning. It just felt unnaturally long this morning because I had been awake for so long, and again, the end was sort of in sight, and I just needed to... It becomes an endurance test at that point. It's not even like I'm necessarily enjoying these movies anymore. It's just I have to get through them.
And again, showing us how subjective things are, I thought it was peppy, and
yeah.
It flew by.
But again, you were slightly rested, not well rested, but you did have a reset. You went home, slept a little, drove back.
Did.
You got out of the theater for a little while.
And it's a great film.
You didn't have seven monsters coursing through your veins.
A week or two ago, we were talking about the greatest horror films, and I was speaking of one shot in Psycho that I particularly like, so I was very attuned to it, and I was waiting for it to show up on the screen, and when it did, I was even more impressed with seeing it this morning on the big screen than even my memory of it, this very specific shot of Norman after he sinks the detective's car, and the carefulness of the lighting, and just how spooky and disturbing that image is. Because half of his face is in shadow, and his face looks like a skull. So I was on the lookout for that. And then, to round up the massacre, we get a return to Patrick's childhood, and a return to movies that were made in the 80s, so people had to wear colors that they don't wear anymore, and sweaters with enormous neck holes, and no matter what the film was about, we had to wind up in a club with synthesizer music.
1985's Fright Night.
Because when I think of vampires, the first thing I think of is sweaters with big neck holes and synth music.
I like Fright Night a whole lot, and the fact that it was last helped me because it gave me sort of a finish line. I was really looking forward to seeing Fright Night on the big screen because I never have. So I was happy that it was programmed last. I really like Fright Night. It is horrifically dated because it's very much of its time, but also... The story that it's telling is actually very classical, sort of a very classic vampire story, and it was obvious that someone said, hey, let's essentially take Dracula and set it smack dab in the middle of the 80s, and that's sort of what they do. The Peter Vincent is sort of the Van Helsing, and he's Dracula, and she's Mina, and you know.
And that's the part I like, and I really think you put your finger on it, that the 80s trappings are very, very difficult to overcome. But at the heart of it, we have this wonderful performance by Roddy McDowall,
yeah.
Of this actor who's sort of lost his way and finds it again, and verities like the importance of faith and the importance of friendship.
But it's also a movie that likes... horror movies.
Yeah,
he's a horror movie host. It's celebrating horror movies. It's very traditional in its rules about vampires. They all come from movies that we've seen.
Very true.
And that's
I just thought that because I didn't have all these great nostalgic feelings about
yeah.
it because I didn't watch it when I was young on cable and VHS, that I thought what Fright Night was trying to do was done much better and more explicitly in Monster Squad,
mm-hmm.
although that was later,
which they showed a few years ago.
With Fred Decker, the writer
and
director in person.
Yeah.
He was delightful.
Yeah, that was great. And then it was over, and we had survived 24 hours. And about how many people would you say remained in the theater at that point?
I'd put it at 200.
Yeah, and Rusty took us all out into the street.
Stopped traffic.
Yeah, and took a picture of everyone who made it. And we had a great time, and we just want to... Thank Rusty for putting it on, and thank the Music Box for hosting it.
And the picture they took.
Yes.
The picture
is going to be on, probably on the Facebook fan page.
Because
the Music Box Massacre, which is run by Jason Kaufman, who's been very good to us, and we want to thank him, and everybody should visit the Facebook fan page for the Music Box Massacre.
But it, the thing of it was.
Yeah, no.
The thing of it was the picture.
The picture. Listen. The picture.